Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We all know the slogan, America runs on Dunkin'. But former Dunkin' chairman Nigel Travis says American companies should be running on something else. Pushback. Travis argues companies that implement a challenge culture that provides everyone, from high-level CEOs to brand-new employees, the freedom to speak up and push back, is the best way to succeed in today's rapidly changing environment. Travis is also the former CEO of the Papa John's pizza chain and has held leadership positions at Blockbuster and Burger King. His new book is called The Challenge Culture: Why the Most Successful Organizations Run on Pushback. And Travis was in our studios this week to talk about his book, and we began by asking him to define what he means by challenge culture.
So what I've found is everyone focuses on the challenge word of the challenge culture rather than there's two words there. I actually think the culture is the more important word. But the challenge part, which people do tend to push on probably because it sounds more exciting, is encouraging people throughout the organization to have a say in what goes on in a business or organization. It doesn't have to be a business. It doesn't have to be a for-profit organization. But I truly do believe that by encouraging everyone in the organization to push back, to come up with new ideas, to find ways of doing things, and they can also improve themselves. So that's truly what it's all about.
One of the adjectives you use in the book that kind of wraps that all together is anti-hierarchical, right? But,
yes.
But most organizations do have some hierarchy, at least on paper. There is a chief executive. There are people who rank below that. So how do you accomplish that when there is some hierarchy?
Well, yes, and I'm not saying get rid of all the hierarchy. I think the organization of the future is going to be very much about being flatter. And I think what it really means, anti-hierarchy, is that if you say the CEO or the leader of the organization, people down the organization can talk to you, can give their ideas, but it really means that the leader has to give those people access to he or her. And one of the things I talk about in the book is these coffee chats, which essentially is a very simple concept. I mean, the way it worked at Dunkin' is we talked to all the people below director level. So people would come in, typically 15 to 20 in the room, and we ran regular coffee chats. And what I try to get is people to talk about things. So what I also try to do is by putting some controversial subjects on the table at the start, I would say, you may want to talk about sales. You may want to talk about our profits. You may want to talk about the last quarter. But you also may want to talk about the recent rumors about potential acquisitions or, you know, what do you think about the Me Too movement and Dunkin'? So you give people some idea of what they can talk about and you're trying to create a safe environment for them, for them then to discuss subjects that they wish to discuss. What I find is that people truly build their engagement with the company. They have a better understanding. And a lot of people have a lot of creative ideas. Too many people go outside and hire consultancies to get information. Most of the information already exists in the business. And I think what you're doing is you're tapping in to people at different levels. And I think certainly, you know, I'm 68. One of the great benefits is tapping into people who are younger, who may be actually more au fait with what the consumer is thinking than I am.
So you're in the habit of having these coffee chats, and I noticed that you also have a cup of coffee on the cover of your book. And the old saying is don't judge a book by its cover. But I do see some significance here, Nigel, which is that Dunkin', under your leadership, sort of increasingly pivoted into a beverage-first, coffee-first yep. brand and away from the core donuts. In fact, we've just recently seen the company drop donuts from the name, which is a change that seemed to begin under your watch. So as you think about that in the context of a challenge culture, how hard was it to change something so iconic about the brand?
Well, I, for one, was very nervous about changing it. It all started about 2.5 years ago. My concern was, you know, to make sure that dropping the donuts part, we weren't going to get big consumer reaction. So we did, I think, 3 different sets of consumer research. I was also very concerned about international. I mean, between our two brands, we're in 69 different markets around the world. And one of the things I've always loved doing is meeting with franchisees and licensees and asking them to vote on subjects. And they all said this was a good thing to do. Didn't mean we did it. We then did more research here. We brought in various agencies to make sure we positioned it. We tied it into our next generation store. and it fitted. But I think the other thing is that the Dunkin' name is seen by consumers as more up-to-date than Dunkin' Donuts. And it does reflect the reality, and this is the point you made, that we're now 60% beverages. So I think it just reflected reality. And here's the good news. Even in the markets where donuts are a huge percentage of our sales, like Southeast Asia, our franchisees have been incredibly supportive and keen to modernize the brand.
So if Dunkin' has evolved to keep up, one of your previous companies is maybe a study in contrast. Blockbuster is the one I'm thinking of. So what did you observe there, maybe even after your own tenure? But what went wrong there that perhaps could have been alleviated by some of the things you learned later on in your career?
I had 10 wonderful years at Blockbuster, and it was a real learning. So your word is highly appropriate. We did a lot of things to keep up to date. I mean, just to play back the tape, every day we got attacked by some new form of technology. I mean, just a few examples. Near video on demand in those days, which was predominantly DirecTV. Every day you'd wake up and there was something that was new.
Redbox or whatever.
Well, I'm going to come back to that because that's a great example. But yes, another good example. The first one that really hit us was Netflix, which was the DVD by mail. This was in 2002, and I actually recall that we kind of dismissed it. We had the opportunity to buy it for $50 million. It's been as high as $160 billion, so, you know, big mistake. We did recover the fumble, so to speak, because we set up Blockbuster Online. It was taking share. It then continued to grow over the next 2 or 3 years, and then Carl Icahn came in, decided that the focus should be on the stores, not the internet. And if you think back, that's not entirely illogical because we went through the whole internet boom, then bust, and there was a lot of skepticism about the internet in the 2000s. I think it was wrong. I think we'd clearly demonstrated that Blockbuster Online could grow, and they continued to demonstrate that after I left. He focused on retail. He then tried to buy Circuit City, and the result was 3 years later, Blockbuster went into bankruptcy.
But was at the time, was there a problem with the culture, a lack of challenge culture that stopped that decision from being made, or was it just, hey, it was the wrong call?
Yeah, I say in the book, I think we could have done a lot more. We could have anticipated ourselves, but yes. I think vending's a really good example. So we had, let's say, relatively successful vending machines set up in Spain, Israel, and the UK. So we tested it in the US, and it didn't work well. Now, most tests fail because people don't execute the test appropriately. They may not do the right marketing to support the test. So what we failed to do at Blockbuster was to test it effectively. Redbox came along. It then made it highly convenient to rent tapes, then DVDs. They're now doing games. And by the way, Redbox is still around. You know, kudos to them. So I learned a lot of lessons, and I think it was we didn't have a strong enough strategic process. We probably didn't have, to your question, a strong enough challenge culture within. We failed to test, and testing protocol, I think, is a huge learning from the Blockbuster situation. I think Blockbuster would still have been around today if they hadn't made the mistake of focusing on the stores rather than the internet.
Or maybe by Netflix.
Yeah. Well, or by Netflix. Yeah. The interesting thing is I tried to apply all those lessons when I was at Papa John's, where we became the online leader, going back 10 years. And at Dunkin', we've tried to stay ahead. So I'm trying to make sure we don't repeat the same mistake.
But so I'm curious whether you think a challenge culture is really necessary, though, for an organization to succeed, because you write a few points in your book about Donald Trump and his management style as kind of a contrast of what you're describing. His first few months in office were very tumultuous, a lot of staff turnover. He seems to surround himself with folks who prefer to affirm his thinking as opposed to questioning it. And he has enjoyed a lot of business success, Nigel, and he is the president after all. So isn't he proof that maybe you don't need a challenge culture? You can succeed anyway.
Good challenge in his own right, Callum. what I would say, though, is it's interesting. Nikki Haley actually said that you can challenge the president. And if you read Bob Woodward's book, Fear, there is clearly a lot of discussion and a lot of dissent that goes on. I think the point I would make, and I'm not criticizing the president here, I think wherever you are, you have to have an open mind. I would argue that every company, every organization needs some kind of challenge. I think over time, I've developed a mind that say, perhaps I'm not right. And I think you have to open that up. And you have to open up, going back to your earlier question about the hierarchy, you have to open up access to a wider range of people, particularly on critical decisions. I mean, perhaps at Blockbuster, we should have done more research or more discussing down in the lower ranks of the organization about vending, and perhaps we would have chosen to go down the vending route.
I want to ask you, Nigel, Boston is a big startup town, and I'm curious about the guidance you would give for creating a challenge culture at a startup, because it strikes me that if you're the CEO of an old business, you're not really responsible for building that business into what it is today. You're kind of in a caretaker's role. But if you are the genius who created a company out of nothing, you know, your instincts have already proven to be really good, at least on some level. And so how do you push back against that person who seemingly has such a great track record?
It comes back to having this open mind that life changes, the consumer changes, whatever you came up with, how do you keep it up to date? That's what failed to happen at Blockbuster. So how do you build in challenge to what you've invented should be the goal. It is very difficult for founders, incredibly difficult. But I come back to one of the things I said right at the start. If I was advising someone who was a founder of a startup, I would say, first and foremost, before you talk about challenge, make sure you've got the culture right. To focus on the culture you need should be a process where you engage as many people in the organization as possible.
You've talked and written about getting buy-in from people farther down in the company. And of course, one way to do that is to invite them to speak their minds and ask questions. Another thing is to just pay them and treat them well, right? And I'm curious how you think corporations bear responsibility for doing that today. You know, in Sears' recent bankruptcy, we've been reading sort of these retrospectives about the company. And the Times had an interesting piece the other day about how somebody who worked at Sears decades ago could have retired with, you know, more than $1 million in today's money in retirement, and how difficult that would be to do as a low-wage worker at a place like Amazon, for example. So, you know, on the other hand, they have corporate shareholders as well who they're responsible to. So how do you balance those things?
I think it's a combination. Point one, tougher to find people, truck drivers, people to work in fast food, welders, you name it, particularly here in the Northeast. So what you need to do is create the right culture. I think that comes first. Has to be an engaging culture where everyone at every level has some level of involvement and has the ability to, if you like, say and ask what they think. I think you need to obviously pay well because people won't come, but then you need to incent them well, and incentives could, in some cases, involve stock options or something like that.
That is Nigel Travis. He is the recently retired chairman of Dunkin' Brands, which owns Dunkin' and Baskin-Robbins. He's also the former CEO of Papa John's Pizza and has held leadership positions at Blockbuster and Burger King. And the new book is called The Challenge Culture, Why the Most Successful Organizations Run on Pushback, and presumably Dunkin' as well. Nigel,
absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kellen.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.